And welcome to another edition of Stormy Weather, news from the frontline in the end times. This is Aeolus Cephas, and I'm coming to you not so live. This week I'll be talking once again with Carrie McCoy. We'll be discussing what it really means to be primal, going into slightly more personal areas this week in terms of our feelings about the opposite sex, how to turn hormonal responses into poetry rather than simply anxiety. And the best way to channel sexual desires, how to maintain a healthy alchemical marriage. I'm always eager to hear your comments, queries, your suggestions, so visit my blog, aeoluscephas.blogspot.com, post a comment, let me know you're out there, let me know that something is getting through. This is an interactive podcast. That is my aim, and my intent here is to open channels to forge new alliances with like minds and creative souls. So please don't settle into the passive role. Be active, be dynamic. Let me know what you're thinking, what you find to agree with and disagree with. These are explorations of the psychic waters in which we are swimming, or possibly drowning. And I am just trying to figure out myself what's really going on in this head of mine and what's going on out there in this crazy world as it nears its climactic phase. So give me some feedback. Okay, so let's move on to the show. Hello, Carrie, and welcome once again to Stormy Weather.
Well, thank you, Aeolus. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Right, so what should we talk about today?
Well, we can go back to primalism.
Yeah, how did you find my thoughts on primal, being primal? Did they ring any bells for you?
They did. The one thing that I started thinking about with regard to primalism was whether it was really linked necessarily to some type of bloodthirsty, sexual, deviant type behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't necessarily, doesn't need to be a Tyler Durden sort of figure to experience primalism. I was wondering if primalism may be more about somebody getting truly in sync and resonating with their assemblage point.
How would somebody resonate with their assemblage point?
Well, I started thinking it may be a good analogy, maybe totemism.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody has a totem or a spirit animal that they identify with.
Right.
And, you know, there would be lions and lambs, not just lions.
Sure. I mean, the idea of getting primal, of connecting to one's animal nature, doesn't necessarily imply violence, but it does imply a very basic level of functioning, wouldn't you say? I mean, it's instinctive.
Right, absolutely. What I was thinking is that somebody could be primal just by living in sync with nature and gardening, if that was how they were resonating.
But don't you think that we all have, I mean, as human beings, that we all have aspects of the primal that correspond with all the different animals, perhaps? And so you say one person could be a lion, another a lamb, that might be the qualities that come to the fore in one's temperament, but we all have the potential to be a lion, don't you think, as well as a lamb?
Well, sure, but wouldn't that be a shifting of the assemblage point? Or changing frequencies.
Did you see that movie, The Sword and the Stone, the Disney movie?
No, I did not.
That's which Merlin is teaching young Arthur magic, sorcery, and he gives Arthur the power to change into the various different animals or to make transformations, and Arthur has to keep transforming from one animal to another to do battle with Merlin. So, you know, whatever Arthur turns into, Merlin turns into something that's the predator of that animal, and so they just keep going, keep making these transformations in order to have the upper hand. So basically Arthur goes through this series of multiple transformations and multiple positions of the assemblage point in order to experience the various different manifestations of the primal, which is very similar to something that Castaneda writes about in his first book when Don Juan teaches Castaneda using psychotropic substances, the little smoke, mushrooms and whatnot, to transform himself into a crow. And he later explains to Castaneda that it's necessary for all sorcerers, beginning of the path, to experience the animal transformations to go to what he calls the place of the beast, because it's the easiest position to move the assemblage point to, or rather the easiest area because there'll be many, many different positions of the assemblage point that correspond with the place of the beast, presumably corresponding to all the different animals. But that this is a shift below, the assemblage point moves downward, and that's relatively easy for this reason. Perhaps because we already have those aspects within us, these animal, could say evolutionarily, where that's in our DNA, all these the different genetic memories of the animals. And so for the sorcerer to go into that place of the beast as a way to experience a total shift at this ambush point, which is a total transformation according to Don Juan. It's not just a movement of consciousness, it's an actual physical transformation. You know, there's many legends and tales of shapeshifters in shamanic cultures and the Native American cultures. But he also says that this is necessary for sorcerers not just to learn about moving the ambush point, but also to find out whether they have a predilection for that. Because it's a trap that a sorcerer can access an enormous amount of power by going into the place of the beast, but because it's a movement below, there it's counter to the interests of the new seers, which is to move consciousness beyond the human, never mind the animal.
To me, you know, a deer grazing would be just as primal as a lion attacking, and it seems to me that. What you just said, it's the easiest area to access is the position of the beast. And that made me think, would that be because the beast has such a sharp psychic impression with the violent nature of the beast?
Well, I don't think, you know, the place of the beast, again, doesn't only apply predatorial or carnivorous beasts. It's be any kind of animal. And in Castaneda's case, it was a crow, which is relatively gentle among the animals.
Okay, I misunderstood.
Yeah, and yet we have that association in a Christian culture, but in occultism as well, is the idea of the beast is very specifically tied in with savagery.
Right, and I guess that's really what I wanted to get at was, is primalism, is that necessarily savagery?
Do you think maybe it relates to the fact that we've suppressed that side of ourselves? And so it's kind of like Tyler Durden again Fight Club, that because this is the aspect of his consciousness that he's suppressed, his id, it has to split off and create its own identity, and it compensates for the passivity and the docility of the conscious ego by embodying all of these savage, darker, more destructive aspects that he's denied. As human beings in denial of the primal, we're already pretty docile and meek, wouldn't you say?
Correct. And, you know, it was a Gnostic belief among certain sects that the soul was reincarnated as long as it has not exhausted the pleasures of the flesh. So we may be talking about a cyclical thing, not constrained to one lifetime.
So
perhaps if somebody in this life is not necessarily resonating with savagery, their primalism could be more elevated. Say they're closer to shedding the need for the flesh altogether, and that's why they're maybe resonating with, say, a deer or some more gentle creature.
Somebody who just chooses to live a very serene and self-contained existence. I can certainly imagine that. I don't think it applies to me. I don't know. How about you? You think that you feel that you've integrated that savage side of yourself?
I don't have bloodlust. I never have. I just don't feel it. I don't think I've exhausted the pleasures of the flesh altogether.
Why, are you a vegetarian?
I have been for a long time, but I fall on and off the wagon according to convenience.
That's the reverse in my case, significantly enough. It's not the reverse. It's actually the same, but I made a conscious choice to start eating red meat again because I felt that I needed to, I suppose, tap into that primal a little bit more.
It's not really, and you know, I know that a lot of people like to link eating meat and violence together, and certainly eating meat entails violence, but it's not exactly what I would equate with bloodlust.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of people like trophy hunters. That would be, in my opinion, that would be a form of bloodlust.
I don't feel any conscious bloodlust either, and I don't think many of my listeners are inclined that way. I don't think many people are, but it doesn't mean that they don't have a capacity for savagery which somehow needs to be channeled, and they may not be conscious of it.
Well, and I agree completely, too. That's why I brought up the whole line of questioning, is because on your last episode, I may have been painting your words in my own mind, but it did sound like go out and get into a bar fight and whatever, you know. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who do like fighting and who do get a kick out of fighting. and who like to see fighting. That's why this ultimate fighting is so popular right now. I think that there is a lot of bloodlust in the general population.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's coming out mostly in aberrational ways, in deviant ways, and sublimated ways. I mean, the obsession with sports, the fascination with violence, sexual violence, and TV and movies, and of course the sort of patriotic bloodlust that gets channeled into, you know, justification for wars and whatnot. All of this is clearly operating at quite a profound level in society, but I think at an individual level, the kind of people who are tuning into their primal are probably those that you're referring to, who do go out and get into bar fights, who are just very physical. And those aren't generally going to be the listeners at Stormy Weather, are they?
I wouldn't think so.
So I think that what you're saying is valid, but we have to take into account that I'm shaping my ideas with something of an idea of the audience that they're being directed towards, a kind of an assumption, really. Well, also, I mean, I'm talking about myself, talking from, through, and to myself, first and foremost, and the ways in which I've experienced this lack in my life from a very young age, this inability to connect to the primal, this distrust of the primal. I grew up in a very sheltered, civilized environment in which everything was packaged and homogenized and all the rest of it, and in which that whole world, a way of life, including sport and extreme machismo and all of those things, were frowned upon in the environment that I grew up in.
No, I grew up in that environment. You know, I grew up in and around Pasadena, Texas, which is where that movie, The Urban Cowboy, was filmed.
Right.
There was a lot of fights at school. I grew up being a skateboarder myself because I didn't like the football players. So the skateboarders were always at odds and kind of getting hassled by the tough football players or whatever, you know, that whole school time rivalry, whatever.
Mm-hmm. So how would you choose to connect to the primal then?
To me, there's no better way to connect to the primal than, say, bungee jumping, or, you know, if I had the funds and I could really, you know, spend some money on pursuing extreme sports, I would love to get into base jumping, which is basically where you put a parachute on and you jump off of a earthbound stationary object, like a bridge or a building.
So then that was a technique for bringing you fully into the moment.
Yes.
I mean, is that your idea of being primal, just being fully present?
Yeah, it's weird because when you're so fully in the present, it's almost kind of comes to the point where you become separated. It's almost like having an outer body experience. When you become so fully immersed in the moment, you forget yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the line blurs.
Kind of like shamanic ecstasy.
I don't know if I've ever experienced that, but it sounds right.
Well, because ecstasy is, the meaning of it is to be out of the body. The shamanic techniques of ecstasy are often to do with very intense physical activity, like dancing for hours and hours without stop, or in the case of the Mayans, are very extreme, that they would drive needles through their tongues and through other
right.
parts of their body.
Okay.
And that would bring them so much into the body that it was as if they would go through a gateway within the body and come outside of the body, you might say. It's like going into another realm, another dimension through the physical.
It's almost a paradox. You lose yourself, you lose your personal self so much, and that's how you contact yourself more so.
Mm-hmm. I mean, don't you think all these things that are so extreme, is it a way of compensating the fact that we've just lost the ability to be in the moment just through the most natural, normal activities, just like taking a walk or having sex? These are things that potentially could bring us into the moment without having to drive needles through our flesh or jump off buildings.
Well, I think you can be in the moment in any given situation, but every moment has its level. You know, you could sit there and watch the sunset and be fully immersed in that moment and really capture it, but it's different than something that would produce adrenaline in your system.
Sure, yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily diminish how much you take from each moment. They're just different types of moments.
Yeah, well, it is an interesting question, paradox even, that a yogi meditating on a mountaintop, keeping completely still for 12 hours, presumably is connecting to the primal in that way, awakening the kundalini. And that would be the primal experience, and maybe in its purest form would be totally passive. And yet we think of, as you're pointing out, and I was kind of falling into that trap myself with my own descriptions of the prime was taking this very literal idea of what is a primal experience, that it's to do with actual physical contact, with physical intensity, with expression of intense emotions, passion.
Yeah, and I think that for some people that would definitely, that's what they would need in order to have a primal experience.
Right.
But I don't think all people do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some people can have a primal experience. Some people are just more sensitive and perhaps further along the evolutionary path. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's a whole question unto itself, isn't it, really? I wouldn't necessarily want to go there. But in terms of temperament, people have very different temperament, and they also have different conditioning, as we've just observed between you and I, which means that there are different sort of experiences are going to confront us. You know, we would need to use different experiences to confront ourselves, and I think that's a big aspect of what is a primal experience also, is what allows us to confront our own shadow, that
right.
undenied aspect of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the two ideas got somewhat, they overlapped in the last podcast, as I was talking about the primal experience, but I was also talking a lot about the disowned shadow, which is always my favorite subject.
But think about the polar opposite. Imagine a young man who grew up in violence, and violence was his escape, and that's all he knew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his shadow would be tenderness and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a primal experience for him would be to be compassionate and kind. That's what he would be so so afraid of, to really strip himself down and try to feel kindness and compassion and to not hide behind the violence and the cruelty. That would be his primal experience.
Well, that would be a way to refine the primal, wouldn't it? I guess what I was directing my attention towards on the show was ways to open to the primal, experiences that would actually allow the primal to move through us so that we could then start to refine it. Because if we haven't, it's like the alchemy of lead and gold. If we want to create gold, if we want to perform the alchemy, well, first of all, we need to gather the lead together. And so I feel that in our culture, that the primal, in its most obvious sense of the word, as in the raw sexuality and the capacity for savagery and for violence and the basic connection to nature and all these aspects that we think of as animal, is pretty much disowned. We don't really have much access to that in our day-to-day lives. So I was addressing this idea and how spirituality, so-called, heightened awareness. In order to get to that, we need, first of all, to actually get the raw material, the energy, that's going to take us into these new states of consciousness, and that is found in these darker realms of the unconscious, which I've equated with the primal. So your hypothetical thug or young kid who's just raised on violence and surrounded by violence, his challenge, he's already in touch with the primal. Too much so, you might say, because there's too much primal experience coming through him. He's comfortable with that primal thing because it's all he knows. But what he's not comfortable with, what he has no clue about, is how to refine that primal energy into something that is more than merely brutish, more than just survival or expressions of hostility or sexuality. This would be that's the alchemy that potentially can come
yeah.
about.
Right, and that's kind of like, if you're talking about, I know you've brought up Pluto's law as kind of your basis of your philosophy, right?
Right.
And so this young thug, it could be said that he was born as a seed, if you want to use that analogy. He's already deep under the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And now he just needs to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
And what you were addressing with the audience would be someone who is afraid to burrow down to that place,
mm-hmm.
away from the light.
Yeah, well, it's interesting subject. And there's a lot of people out there, I suppose. There's a lot of young men that are like you're describing, who are already deep in the earth, but they don't have the wherewithal to sprout, to start moving back towards the surface.
Right. So that's a conundrum. If you begin underground, how do you find your way? If you've never seen the light, if you start out at the bottom, completely resonating with savagery, then how do you even grasp the concept of light and notice spring forth from the earth?
Well, that's a very good question. The only thing that's coming to mind is a bit of a cliche, but but love, sensual love, because the most primal of young men, or the most savage and brutal of young men, are still susceptible to that feeling, because they definitely, sex is one way that they express their primalism and the way that they own their manhood, and one thing that they're going to feel good about is being good lovers, isn't it?
I guess.
This is quite a challenging subject we're on here. Not entirely sure how to proceed this.
Well, I'm not either. It
line.
Is complex, and I've thought about this before.
You've thought about the question of unrefined masculine energy?
Not necessarily, but I have considered from a more of a Gnostic point of view, you know, if we're not exhausted by the pleasures of the flesh, then we're not really fulfilling some type of, I'm going to say, spirit cycle, even though it's probably somewhat of a misnomer and doesn't really convey what I'm thinking. But are we here to get our fill of earthly debauchery?
Yeah, I have to take exception that you're equating sensual pleasure or sexual alchemy and all the rest of it with debauchery. So creating once again a dichotomy, like somehow if we were to refine our primal natures, we would thereby become less primal, less sexual, less physical, whereas my feeling is that we become more so because we're more tuned to the subtle aspects of the physical. So we're refining it, we're refining our coarser nature, but we're going deeper into it at the same time.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm following you on that.
Well, let's bring it to a personal level then. You mentioned that you were looking forward to a time when your libido had diminished to nothing and you could just concentrate on other things besides sexual gratification, yeah?
Right.
So that, presumably, based on that, you felt oppressed, enslaved, tormented by your sexual appetites?
Well, not necessarily tormented by it, but I mean, if it's an insatiable appetite, then it becomes sort of a chore to, you know, to keep up with it all the time.
You see, I can't really relate to that. I'm not saying I doubt it. If that's your experience, then that's your experience. But I personally can't actually relate to that. I can't imagine what it'd be like to be so sexually insatiable that I got bored with my own appetites. Because that's what you're saying, right?
Yeah. I mean, where does it end?
Where does it
it's
end?
It's just an appetite feed. Don't you ever get tired of preparing dinner? I have the same phenomenon with dinner. You know, at dinner time, I'm like, oh, Lord, here it goes. What are we going to eat tonight? I don't feel like cooking anything. I wish I had a magic pill that I could just take with a glass of water and get all the nutrients I need, because I really don't feel like dealing with dinner.
Right. No, I never ever feel like that. I might feel lazy about preparing dinner, but then I can just make a sandwich. But the thing is if I'm hungry, I'm very delighted that I'm hungry, because it means I can eat. And I just love the pleasure of eating.
Well, so do I, but I eat 4 or 5 times a day. You
well,
know?
All the better.
365 days a year, I'm on my 37th year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time I want to eat a meal, it is a chore. It doesn't mean I don't appreciate eating, I don't enjoy eating. But sometimes, you know, I just don't really feel like dealing with the task at hand, even though I am hungry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes me a weirdo.
I don't think it's that uncommon. I mean, I've definitely heard about it before, but it's not something that I can relate to. Simply because I enjoy eating, I enjoy the process of preparing food, because I have the anticipation while preparing it that I'm going to be eating it. See what I mean? So, I mean, eating is very much part of the ritual of the day. It's such a major part of our culture, food. And it can be a drag or it can be a delight, depending on how much we put into it, how much creativity we put into it. I mean, I like to cook. I like to use my imagination. I like to surprise myself and how it's going to taste. And the same hopefully applies to sex, that it's not simply like an appetite that needs to be appeased so that I can get to sleep. This is every time is like the first time, potentially, with sex. Because it's always unknown, it's always mysterious. It's always like every time I cook a meal, because I don't do recipes, it's always the first time I've done that meal. It's always going to be slightly different, even if I've got a basic dish that I want to do, which mostly I don't even have that. But even then, I will vary the ingredients because it's all spontaneous. So every time I have a meal, it's slightly different. And the same would apply to the sexual experience, is that it just seems to be a constant challenge, not just a physical, what are you describing, a function, not just a bodily function. In fact, I don't see it as a bodily function at all, sex, in the way that eating is, because I've spent many years celibate in my life, and it hasn't been particularly difficult. It's been emotionally difficult to be celibate because I've become infatuated with women that I wanted to be sexual with, and so that caused a great deal of emotional discomfort.
You don't have to be celibate to become infatuated with women. I mean, that's part of why I said it would be nice not to have the sexual desire, because, I mean, honestly, if I'm talking to a beautiful woman, I can't really keep the thought out of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Have you not found there's a way to channel that sexual interest into the interaction with the female rather than it distracting you? Because when you're sexually attracted to someone, and I don't know how extreme you're talking about here, I mean, do you actually get an erection while you're talking to a woman? Do you feel like you could just pounce on her and just tear her clothes off sometimes?
Well, I'm sure every instance is different. But sure, at times.
Sometimes.
But, you know, I mean, if you're talking to a beautiful woman and your heart starts beating faster,
yeah,
your palms may get a little sweaty. I mean, it causes a physical reaction.
Well, sure, but that's more like anxiety, isn't it?
Well, it's becoming excited. I don't know if it's necessarily anxiety.
Okay, but
sure anxiety may have a little to do with it, but it's not like stage fright.
No, but I think it's a key distinction that here needs to be made, because the difference between excitement and arousal. And I would say that excitement is of the mind and arousal is of the body, and that sexually speaking, excitement is totally not only superfluous, but actually interferes with sexual connection, because we're in the head and we're thinking about ways in which we want this to go, and whatever turns us on mentally. I mean, it may be necessary to use mental excitation at times because we're not that completely in the body, but wouldn't you say that sex is more satisfying, more fluid, and more fulfilling when it's just a more purely physical state of arousal rather than the mental excitation?
I'm sorry, could you
repeat the question? Well, actually, we don't have to repeat the question. I'm kind of curious of what we're talking about with the woman. So you meet a beautiful woman, yeah? And you're saying that you're in a state of excitation because your palms are sweaty, whereas...
I was just using that as an example. I'm not saying my palms actually get sweaty. What I'm really, I guess a better way to say it would be, I would like to experience talking to everybody the same way I talk to a fat, greasy old man.
Yeah.
Who has no effect on me, right?
But then what if you wanted to be sexual with this fat, greasy old man? No, I'm sorry, that wasn't what I meant to say.
It's not going to happen. And that's the thing. It's not a conscious decision that I'm making.
Yeah, and is that why you don't like it? Is that why you object to it? That you feel that your physiology is somehow...
Well, I don't necessarily object to it. I mean, I've enjoyed it, but I'm looking forward to the day when it doesn't have an influence over me. And not necessarily even looking forward to the day. I'm not counting the days, but it will be interesting.
Well, see, I would say, because this is back to the refining the primal thing and the lead and gold, I don't think as a sorcerer that you can... This is not something that you want to put behind you. This is something that needs to be transformed. So if I would guess, I would suggest that that's what you're experiencing is not... I mean, if you're experiencing a sort of frustration or a weariness or an impatience or however you want to describe it with these hormonal responses, it's because that they're demanding your attention as a sorcerer, because this is the raw energy, the kundalini energy, which you need to refine and channel into heightened awareness, into new realms of consciousness. You can only do that by actually going fully into the experience of that hormonal energy, no? And so with the woman in question, what I was getting at was that, you know, I've often said and I've often thought that Jesus Christ would be a being who would walk around with a perpetual hard-on. You know, like a warrior on the battlefield, the old warriors said they went into battle with raging hard-ons because that primal was just totally activated. Their kundalini was, you know, their pinball machine was fully lit up and they were completely in the moment. And all of that energy, the primal energy, was flowing through them, and so it would be flowing through their genital organs as well, even though they weren't actually using them. Because, like, if you're giving a good massage, okay, you don't want to confuse a massage with a seduction technique, so getting aroused can interfere with that, because then you're thinking about putting the moves on, and so you're not actually getting into the massage. But if you're sufficiently detached from your own hormonal responses so that you can experience them without being confused by them or swayed by them, then a good massage becomes an even better massage if sexual energy is flowing through the hands, no?
So I guess the question we need to be asking is, what would Jesus do when he was talking to, if he would be talking to a sexy girl that turned him on? Would Jesus be turned on if he was talking to, he said he would have a perpetual heart.
Well, he would have a perpetual heart on, so he would also be turned on, well, not turned on by, but he would be in a state of arousal perhaps when he was talking to the fat, greasy old man also.
Jesus' perpetual heart on just cancels out his
personal
his
interest.
Lust for attractive women, though.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the only difference would be that when he was actually going to use that hard-on, as opposed to when he was just allowing the energy of it to flow through his words and his eyes and his being. Because, you know, what I've experienced, and it's not often, because if I'm with a beautiful woman, the arousal I tend to experience is more of the kind that you mentioned, the mental excitation which causes anxiety and nervousness. But if I on occasion actually feel physically aroused in the presence of a woman, I find that's very freeing. It frees me up because it gives me all this confidence. See, because I feel I'm standing here with an erection talking to this woman. I could literally rip her clothes off and make love to her right now at the drop of a hat. That gives me a sense of peace, you might say, total confidence in my masculinity. And then I feel that I can also give her my total undivided attention, see, because I'm every cell of my body is actually straining towards that person.
Yes, I see what you're saying, but it doesn't really get to the point I was making, which is that there is a difference when I talk to a woman I find attractive from me talking to someone that I don't find attractive.
Yes.
Whether, you know, I want to try to address it as a sorcerer or not, there's still a difference that I have no control over.
No.
And that is what I was really trying to say, that I think that'll be interesting. You know, I'm not necessarily looking forward to it and counting down the days, but it will be interesting to have everybody completely equaled.
I think you should say would be, Kerry, because there's plenty of 8-year-old guys out there, and probably most of them, who still lust after females, no?
True.
Maybe more than ever, because they can't get laid at that point.
Well, yeah, I didn't think about that. Way to go, man. Ruin it. Ruin the fantasy.
Well, I think it's a valid, well, not fantasy, but a valid objective. I once read something from Kenneth Grant, which was to the effect that a sorcerer will only be truly free when he's completely indifferent to the female and all her charms.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, well, and I think it is, in many ways, it's the ultimate test, isn't it? Because as primal males, we have been programmed millions of years of genetic programming to be aroused at the sight of an attractive female, or indeed of any female, if we're sufficiently tuned into the primal, just the smell of a female, potentially.
I can't speak for everybody in the listening audience, but I've never been unfaithful to any of my girlfriends, and I've been married now for 9 years. I've never been unfaithful to my wife. And, you know, I really make a concerted effort to show women the utmost respect. I always make sure to make eye contact and not look at their boobs or whatever, you know, treat them as objects.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess because I make such a concerted effort, it just made me more aware of the fact that no matter how hard I try, there is a difference. There is a difference when I'm talking to a woman I find attractive,
mm-hmm.
and I can't do anything about it, which, you know, to me, I find that kind of irritating, the fact that I can't control this physiological response.
That's because it limits you in ways that you don't like to be limited, yeah?
I suppose. Not so much. Well, I guess you could say it's limiting. I don't know. The same way when you get up to do a public performance, and no matter how many times you've got up on stage and played guitar and sing and do your thing, before a public show, you get nervous and you kind of get the shakes. And you sit here and think to yourself mentally, well, I've done this before. I know how to do this. It's completely irrational that I'm getting nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's coming after me. I'm going to get up there and play some songs and have a good time. And you can ask yourself, why am I getting nervous? Why is this happening? Where is it coming from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What can I do with this nervous power? You know.
Well, that's the question,
energy.
Isn't it? Because it is energy. That nervousness, that is adrenaline, that gives you energy that then goes into the performance.
Right.
I mean, haven't you found generally that it's certainly it's a saying, isn't it? Is that if you're not nervous before a performance, watch out.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Right.
So the performers actually need that adrenaline rush of the anxiety that they take onto the stage, and then once they're actually performing, once they're engaged, it transforms. I mean, from my experience performing and public speaking, the anxiety does vanish almost as soon as I begin to do or say whatever it is I'm there to do.
Yeah, it does definitely diminish.
So do you ever express any of these feelings with these women? Do you ever tell them that they're beautiful, for example?
Well, I'm married now, so I can't,
You
you know.
can't tell a woman she's beautiful because you're married?
Absolutely not. That's exactly how it works, Aeolus.
Not for me, Carrie. Definitely
Well,
doesn't. In fact, it has the opposite effect for me since I was married again recently. Again, I don't know how that works, but very primal marriage.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. I've been much felt much freer to respond to other women and their beauty and to show it and express it.
Well,
It's
that's interesting. You see, you and I seem to have very different experiences, life experiences. I find that amazing because, for example, if I was out with my wife and we went to the coffee shop and the girl behind the counter, I thought she was beautiful and she was friendly and smiling to me. And I said, I think you're beautiful. I don't think my wife would respond very well to that.
Well, but what if she wasn't there?
Well, that's not what I'm talking about. I mean, I'm talking about what if you're out with your wife?
Well, no, that would also work for me also. My wife, I don't think, would object to that. And if she did, then I'd be quite happy to for her to object. You know what I'm saying? Because any sort of possessiveness in a relationship runs counter to the alchemy, for sure. But that's another issue. That you had said that you wouldn't tell a woman that she was beautiful because you're married, not because it would offend your wife. So what if you were out and about on your own in a bar and you saw a woman and you knew that you weren't going to seduce her, but you still, because you're married, but you still felt that hormonal response? Wouldn't a way to relieve it be to express it by saying, "My God, you're beautiful. I'd like to throw you down and fuck you right now, but unfortunately I'm married, so I can't."
Yeah, I don't know. That's a really good question.
I think it would. I think it would diffuse the situation as well. Because the thing is with beautiful women, or just women in general, sexy women, particularly those who know that they are, because then it's a conscious sort of power play that's going on, is that they actually expect us to and require us to notice them.
Well, that would be a really good discussion for your blog. I would really like to hear the readers' responses. How do they react in situations like that, whether they're married or not? And even from the women who are married, I mean, if they're out and they find a man really attractive, do they feel like they should, or that would be a good idea for them as a fledgling sorcerer or a practicing sorcerer to go up to that man and say, I'm married, but I just wanted to let you know I think you're incredibly hot. Man, I'd really love to just throw you down and fuck your brains out, but I can't. But I just want to let you know.
Well, I think just to, don't you think, just to air those feelings and to bring them to the surface would be very liberating and empowering just in itself.
I
'Cause
don't
it's
know. To me, airing feelings like that is like window shopping, and actually, it's more frustrating than it is cathartic.
Why, have you tried it?
Well, no, but I don't like window shopping. I
Well,
hate going out and.
but you made that comparison. To me, it's more like poetry than window shopping. It's turning, again, it's transforming that hormonal stuff into self-expression, because it is just a raw energy. And okay, one can see a beautiful woman and go home and paint a painting, or masturbate, of course. But whatever, one can take that energy somewhere else. But one can also just express it right there in the moment, which I think is always a better sorcery rather than holding on to stuff. To be playful with that energy, I suppose, is what I'm moving towards. And as I said last week, that the primal energy wants to be playful. That's
Yeah.
its natural expression, is playfulness. As you see with animals in nature, kittens learn to hunt through playing.
I
And
would agree with that. I would concur completely that I think that primalism is very playful. Whether or not it has to do with, violence or bloodlust, is debatable amongst different people, but definitely that it's playful and spontaneous.
Well, you think of cats that don't have to hunt, they still play, don't they? So you could
Absolutely.
say that what appears to be that playfulness is a function of a predatorial thing, it may be the reverse, that actually the predatorial thing is just a function of this basic playful nature of the universe and of all the creatures in the universe, that we're all hardwired for play. that's the whole nature of creation, is playful. That's my feeling. And that as humans, we've lost touch with the primal, we've lost touch with our with that raw savagery and even that raw sexuality. And but what's, I mean, the reason I think that I feel that this is so essential that we regain touch with it is because we've lost touch with our sense of play. And the whole sexual thing is such a very clear illustration of this, is that, speaking personally again, I find it incredibly restricting to be attracted to a woman. It's what you're talking about. If I meet somebody and I like them and I get on with them and I can connect, but if I happen to be attracted to that person, then everything goes out the window. I can't function properly. I can't think clearly. I'm not able to just... And so I end up treating this person actually less well and being less myself with them because I'm attracted to them.
That's exactly what I was trying to convey. I apparently didn't do a good job, but that's what I'm talking about.
Well, that is infuriating, but I would say that the solution is not to suppress that stuff, on the contrary, but to actually be able to express it. Essentially, I enjoy, I'm sure you're the same, or I would enjoy being with a beautiful woman more than any other kind of person on the planet. Yeah, taking, you know, somebody I don't know. If it's a stranger, if I'm meeting a stranger, if it's a beautiful woman, then my attention is definitely, you know, more finely tuned because of that. And so, and yet because of the anxiety, I feel I end up enjoying myself less. So if I could just free up that energy and express it, then I'd no longer experience the anxiety. And I could just enjoy the fact that I'm in the presence of a beautiful woman. And I could share that. And so she could enjoy the experience of being appreciated in a playful, open way that wasn't sort of being pushed by this ego agenda of I'm trying to get you into bed now, which is what makes the whole sort of interaction between the sexes so kind of heavy and so tense, is that there's a hidden agenda and yet we both know it's there. So it's hidden, but it's not even well hidden. It's just we're too afraid to speak about it.
But what is the point in speaking about it? I mean, what does that really accomplish? It may even make things more awkward. And, you know, it may turn what might have been an awkward friendship into a non-friendship.
Well, I think if you try and speak about it seriously and somberly, and we need to discuss the fact that I'm sexually attracted to you, and then, yeah, it's probably counterproductive. But if you really can make light of it, it's a good thing I'm married, because otherwise I'd be going crazy just staring at your boobs right now. And just be childlike about it, about this, you know, the thing that really does make us adults, I think, is this is the key, see, is that when children grow up, they enter into their sexuality and they lose their ability to play when they need it the most. You know, what's more playful than sex?
All right. Yeah, it's a real sticky topic and situation.
As it were.
Yes.
It's a good subject. Was that anything to do with what you said you were going to ask our listeners about? Was that something else entirely?
Yeah, you know, I like to call your listeners, you know, trust fund occultists, because I imagine they're all wealthy, sort of charming, you know, people who live a life completely opposite of mine, who have all kinds of free time on their hands.
Uh-huh.
All kinds of books laying around in their personal libraries. But anyways, I have this book, and it's called The Wordsworth Dictionary of the Occult. And after listening to a couple of your last podcasts, I was thumbing through it, and I came across The Orgy, a Love Offering.
Uh-huh.
And what it does is basically breaks down the orgy in occult terms, and it talks about the Gnostic and occult tendencies have always made frequent references to the principles of Hermes, yada, 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 and it goes on and on. So anyways, in this book, on the orgy page, there's this little side note, and it says, the Apostle Thomas asked Jesus, "We have heard that there are men on this earth who take the sperm of men and the menstrual fluids of women, put them in lentils and eat them, saying, we believe in Esau and Jacob. Is that allowable or not?" Jesus was angry and said, "Truly, I say, this sin is worse than all other sins and iniquities." That is just so bizarre, and I've never read that anywhere else before.
So let's see, sperm, menstrual fluids, and lentils, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, well, listeners, try this at home and get back to us. And,
have you heard, you come across this and you get a couple of answers for us, so I'd really like to read about it.
Are you asking me now or just generally?
Yeah, out to the
out there, yeah.
Yeah, right.
I have a feeling that if any of our listeners have tried the lentil, menstrual, and sperm soup, they're probably not going to admit to it.
Well, they might have a friend that said something to them about it. So.
So has that piqued your curiosity enough to, obviously not enough to actually try it, just enough to try and
Oh, no,
find.
I'm not gonna. I probably won't be trying that.
So why do you think that Jesus thought it was the sin of sins?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting.
Yeah, I've never heard that recipe before.
Yeah,
It's
I haven't
kind
either.
of ironic because it's mixed up cooking with sex
Yeah.
in a very graphic way.
Well, it kind of reminds me of just all the blood drinking in general that you hear about in connection to the elite and their weird satanic parties.
Their efforts to get primal.
Right.
So let's discuss your sex life then.
Well, if we're going to discuss my sex life, we have to discuss your sex life also.
My sex lives, you said plural.
Life? Did I?
Yeah, that was a
Wow,
great
Freudian
Freudian
slip.
slip.
I guess I imagine. I don't know. Never mind.
I have many, many wives.
Yeah.
Yeah, but keep it to yourself.
Well, you
Thank
got some type of lucid dream sex life going on too, probably, huh?
I've been dreaming a lot about the anima lately. I had a dream recently in which the anima was driving me nuts with her anxiety.
Who? What are you
The
saying?
anima, my female self.
Oh.
She entered into this lizard, and the lizard was running all over my body. So I grabbed the lizard and I threw it across the floor, and it shattered. It was made of glass. And when the lizard shattered, the female who had been inside the lizard entered into me, and I was terrified. It was like her anxiety passed to me. And I was looking in the mirror, and I could sort of see a very subtle way. I could see her head around me like a cocoon, like I was inside her head. And I think all my aura was the anima, the female's head. And I flew into the sky then, and was kind of hoping to trying somehow to get away from this awful realization that I'd been taken over by this female. And I woke up sweating and groaning. It was very much a nightmare that I later interpreted as quite a positive dream, because it seemed if that was the anima, then I'd been trying to objectify her, putting her in the lizard. That has personal significance I won't go into, relates to two of my other wives, let's say. And so it seemed to represent the objectifying of the anima, as in projecting it onto this lizard. But then the lizard was tormenting me because it was running all over my body, and so I hurled it across to get it away from me, and then it shattered, and so there was no place for the anima to go, having destroyed this objectification I was projecting. The anima then had to return whence it came within myself, so I had to integrate the anima. But it was terrifying because it felt like, because I'd forgotten that the anima was part of me, it was like I was being taken over by this female.
Sounds like a complex relationship you have in your dream life.
Yeah, now I dreamt about the anima again last night, and she had three eyes. It was also a bit of a nightmare. So yeah, I think I have quite a few issues to work through. Well, don't we all?
Yeah.
When it comes to the female, and I guess bringing us back to the subject we've been on with women and encounters with women, that this seems to be the difficulty that I have is connecting to women and relating to women as people, as opposed to objects of desire. And I don't just mean physical desire, I don't even mean primarily physical. It's actually a subtler form of desire, which is for some sort of communion with the other, with that aspect of myself that is totally unknown to me. And so I can be totally fascinated. I'm sure most of our male listeners will agree, totally fascinated, enchanted by the presence of a female, if she has the right qualities and attributes that I can then project onto that, this idealized image of my anima self. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
I was just
Oh.
thinking, well, Carrie's my opposite half here, so he's gonna not have a clue where I'm coming from. And when he sees a woman, he probably just thinks, nice tits.
No, that's not true. No, that's not at all.
Okay, so, but you have a more physiological response, would you say?
Well, I don't know. There's really no definitive, I have this real concise cut answer for anything as far as women go, but when I say I love everything about women, when I see a woman that I'm attracted to, I just want to take off with her, just go away someplace, get lost with her for a couple of weeks, just immerse myself completely with her.
Have you ever been in love with a woman or obsessed with a woman that you couldn't have sex with?
No, I pretty much ended up having sex with most of the women. I mean, other than like celebrities or whatever.
Right.
But in real life, yeah, I mean, it wasn't really an issue for me to hook up with women.
Have you ever noticed like a difference in your perception of a woman before and after having sex with her for the first time?
No. Well, yes, I take it back. I just thought of one girl in particular, yeah.
Can you describe it?
I'd rather not.
I don't mean like the personal details, but just sort of in a general way. Like, well, the reason I was asking is because I've had many infatuations, relations with women or girls where I haven't been able to consummate with them. I've had a very platonic relationship with them, and I found that that's actually fed and nourished and nurtured the more abstract passion for them.
Well, you know, I'm pretty well balanced with my feminine and male aspects, personally, I believe. And so I get along with women easily. Usually sex is a fun, playful thing and mutually enjoyable. But on one occasion that I can think of in particular, this lady, woman, whatever, sex to her was an issue. I don't know how to describe it. It's kind of like she wanted to be punished, and I wasn't there to punish anybody or hurt anybody. She wanted to be punished and hurt, and I wasn't there to play dungeon master or whatever.
So your psyches didn't match up in that way.
No, but see, what I was saying is that did affect the way I viewed her afterwards, because afterwards I really didn't want to have anything to do with her because she had so much, I don't know, kind of negative emotional baggage around her. And after being with her that way, it became more obvious, you know, that she had some issues. She was trying to punish herself for something, and I really didn't want to get into it.
But did you oblige her to some extent?
Nope.
And did she resent that?
Yeah, I think so. I think afterwards, she kind of had this attitude that I was like some type of snot or something, that I was, you know, I thought that I was better than her. So. Yeah, I just really didn't feel like... It's kind of hard to even really describe it. It's just...
But were you emotionally involved with her before that happened?
Not so much.
So it was quite casual then?
Yeah, we're kind of acquaintances.
So have you not experienced in yourself then anything that would be the reverse equivalent of that, any desire to dominate or abuse females?
No, not really at all.
No.
It's just all... If it's role play, if it's fun, then that's one thing. But if it's serious... Then no.
Well, it seems like there would be a blurry line there between role-playing and when it becomes serious. How would you know for sure?
Well, I wouldn't, because I'm just not in the state of mind to be serious about that kind of thing. So I can't experience the seriousness of wanting to have truly abusive relationship with someone. So I can't experience it.
Well, it wouldn't be abusive if the other person wanted that, would it? Role-playing, to be effective, one has to get carried away by the roles. So it becomes real, but at the same time you're conscious of the fact that you're playing a role, that you are acting it out. It's just like any good performer, no?
Yeah, it's a blurry line to discuss, you know, to put into words, but in real life the difference is quite clear. It's just not so easy to put into words. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure. I guess one can only speak personally here.
Yeah.
And personally, I mean, I am aware of a part of my psyche, an aspect of my psyche, which wishes to violate, which wishes to dominate, to use force, rape fantasies, for example. I'm just aware of that part of my psyche. I don't imagine it's that unusual in a male psyche. It may even be universal. I think it's fairly unusual to be aware of it.
I don't think that I really have that in my psyche. It's not that I'm unaware of it. I'm on a different channel altogether, you know?
So you're one of these more evolved beings then that you were referring to earlier, who just manifest the primal by being deers grazing in the meadow?
Well, I don't know if I'm a deer grazing in the meadow. I just really don't feel the need to dominate women.
What if a woman wants to be dominated?
Yeah, I actually enjoy that, but not if it's in an actual malicious, mean manner.
Well, no, I wasn't talking about that. I mean,
well, there's you know, it's out there, so I just wanted to clarify.
Right.
You know, I mean, I really don't like being beat up and choked or whatever, but I like dominant women.
Oh, you do? You like to be dominated?
Yeah, it's fun. And I'm not saying that's like the one role I'm stuck on in life, but it certainly doesn't. I'm certainly not opposed to it. And let me just say this. Weak women, I just don't find them as attractive and stimulating as strong, dominating women.
Yes, but in my experience, the strong women are the ones who most want to be dominated. And that's quite extensive experience. I've known quite a few strong women, and I haven't always been able to play that role. And it's more than a role, because I will go out on a limb here and risk controversy by saying I think it's our natural roles as males to dominate women, just as we see in the animal kingdom, and make a distinction between domineering and dominating, in the sense domination wouldn't come from a place of ego, it wouldn't be a mental domination, it was just purely physical, in the way that in the animal kingdom, the male takes the female. And the female often resists that. In the world of cats, for example, sex between cats is basically rape, or it would be in a human if that was acted out in a human level, because the female cat fights the male cat off, and if the female is stronger, then she chases the male off. The male actually has to dominate completely the female and force himself on her, and then and only then does she submit. Okay, and that's kind of extreme. I'm not suggesting that to be primal and to be real men, we go out there and just take women whether they want it or not. But within the relatively safe context of a relationship or a marriage, an alchemical marriage, to play those roles, I think is not just healthy, but the essence of sorcery. Because then we're taking it to a more impersonal level where there's no need to be nice or polite or considerate or any of those things. It's just raw, primal sexual act, which doesn't mean that it's violent or rough necessarily, but it has that power. And again, talking personally, I mean, my experience is that there's a very basic yin-yang dynamic at play, which is that the male needs to release what he has inside, whereas the female needs to contain it. Female is just this dynamo that's just waiting to go off, just needs to be tapped. And then once it's tapped, the male has to contain that force. And so there's this very delicate balance there, which I'm not sure I can actually speak about anymore, because I feel like I'm going to get into trouble if I do. All right, so that's it for another week. Once again, visit the blog, aoliscafus.blogspot.com. Post your comments, queries, suggestions, objections. Just let me know what you're thinking. If you'd like to look at Carrie's art, you can find it at his website. That's carriemccoy.com. That's it for another week. This is Aeolus Cephas, bringing you news from the front line in the end times.